1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 238, a memorial to Sam Taylor, with panelists Virginia Burgess, Eugene England, Sarah Weston, and Paul Smith.
Can you hear me? I want a signal. You can't? Is it not on? Okay, can you hear me? I want everybody to hear me. I mean, I have a soft voice, and so I'm conscious of the fact that I need to speak up. This is the Sam Taylor Memorial Panel for anyone who wonders where they are. And we have assembled a group of friends and relatives to talk about Sam Taylor, and I think it's time to get started. I have the privilege of being the chairperson and one of the panelists, and as a longtime friend of Sam Taylor's, I feel it an honor to do this. And I want to introduce the panelists in the order that they will appear. I do want to call attention to the fact that we're really thrilled to have Gay Taylor here. That's Sam's widow, and she hasn't been around for quite a while, so it's really a privilege to have her here with us for this occasion. And Sarah Weston is their daughter, and she's here to be the first panelist, and she's going to talk about what it was like to be the daughter of Sam Taylor, and I'm sure she'll have a lot to talk about. Sarah got her BA from the BYU in Spanish. She got a master's degree from Santa Clara University in counseling psychology. She got a PhD from BYU in educational psychology, and she worked as a teacher and counselor for 10 years and then retired to become a full-time mother, I think a full-time daughter to Sam and Gay, because she did a lot of traveling with Sam and both of them, and so that was one of her big jobs, too. She is married to a retired professor of English from BYU. He told me that's why he would do it. And he holds a PhD from Stanford University in English Literature. And he's the founding editor of Dialogue, the author of a number of books, including The Quality of Mercy and Brother Brigham. But there's lots more and lots of essays. If you've been around very much, you've seen and heard from him. And he has a wife, Charlotte. They're the parents of 6 children, and they have 13 grandchildren. Paul Smith has recently retired from the military, where he spent 20 years in the military intelligence. He has a BA from BYU, presently working on his PhD in philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. There's lots more I could say about all these people, but we want to get on to the job. He's married to Darrell Gibson, and he's the father of 4 children. I'm Virginia Burgess. I got my master's from the University of Utah in educational psychology in 1970. I retired in 1987 after working 16 years as a counselor. My husband and I have just celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary, and we are the parents of 5 children and 20 grandchildren. Now that's the panel. And we'll start with Sarah.
Good morning. I promise you that my mother and I didn't travel here with the idea of selling books, but my father always liked to have the last word, and his sense of timing was impeccable. And we'd like to tell you about this novel called Take My Advice, Mr. President. It is a compilation of 10 stories of his that appeared in Liberty Magazine. The first two were the basis of The Absent-Minded Professor. They're very humorous, fun, short stories. And they will be available at the back of the room for a dollar on your way out if you're interested in picking up one of these books. My mother and I would like to thank Sunstone and the panel members who have chosen to honor Dad by their participation. A special thank you to Virginia, the main organizer. Dad would be so grateful and humbled. Someone suggested that I should begin by saying, I know where all the bodies are buried. But that would not be entirely true, and truth and integrity are what Samuel W. Taylor is all about. So I will begin with the first memory I have of my father, helping him in his shop. He had patiently and carefully taught me how to use an oil can on all the critical spots of the various drills, table saws, and lathes, and I felt very important to be allowed and able to help. His shop, you see, was a magical place. Dad could walk in there and a little while later emerge with anything you had requested. Picture frames, lamps, checkerboards, bookshelves, jigsaw puzzles. I didn't know it at the time, but this was just small stuff for him. He had built the house we lived in. Not only did he do most of the carpentry, plumbing, wiring, tiling, and bricklaying, but he also made the doors, much of the furniture, and the adobe bricks for the large living room and patio wall. Dad even made some of the tools necessary for his projects. Incredible multifunction machinery held together and operated simultaneously by huge belts. Years later, when Disney needed some unusual props for workshop scenes, they would scout through Dad's shop and borrow some of the equipment. Dad hand-mowed his 2 acres with a homemade electric mower attached to 500 feet of Romex, which he hauled around on a big spool. That he never made a mistake by mowing through the wire sprawled out behind him is a wonder to us all. But Dad usually didn't make mistakes, and I would describe him as a man with a tangible sense of purpose, whose actions and choices were calculated and whose footsteps were always deliberate. Perhaps this began when he was 8 years old and lost his father. John W. Taylor had been chosen for the mission of being the scapegoat for polygamy so that Reed Smoot could be seated in the Senate. But it broke his heart and his spirit, and he died soon after of cancer at the age of 58. Dad's widowed mother in the small and homogeneous community of Provo was left with 8 children, and the stigma of having been married to a man who had been publicly and profoundly scolded by the church. But Dad was taught to hold his head high, respect his father, find any job he could to help the family, and be thrifty. Dad would later say that his father's presence in the home remained almost palpable, and the severest chastisement his mother could give would be the words, "What would your father think of this?" So at a very young age, Dad was dressed in a big coat to make him appear older and larger and sent to work at the Knight Woolen Mills for 17.5 cents an hour. And engendered in him were 3 critical values, the importance of hard work, which never left him, the burning desire to restore honor to his father, which he did through his book Family Kingdom and his meetings with David O. McKay, which resulted in the full restoration of John W. Taylor's priesthood, office, and blessings as a member of the 12. And finally, the sense of obligation to help those in need. I cannot begin to calculate the tens of thousands of dollars dispensed to any and all family members and friends who ask for help, nor the thousands of hours of time he donated in so many endeavors, especially in reading and critiquing scripts and encouraging aspiring writers. While his generosity to others knew no limits, Dad's thrift at home knew no bounds. His amazing mechanical ability enabled him to repair anything, so World War II field phones are still the means of communication between his office and the house, and my mother still uses the toaster received as a wedding present 64 years ago, whose side doors flip the bread over when they are opened and shut again. All of Dad's writing was done on his well-cared-for, upright, Royal Standard manual typewriter. In a singularly unusual concession to acquisitions, he had two typewriters set up in his office. One was for his spiritual work, he would explain with a twinkling eye, and one was for the profane. I think an amazing thing about Dad was that he could do so many things well. He was a fierce tennis player in his younger days, an expert weaver, a fiddler, an accomplished photographer who did all his own developing in his homemade darkroom, a successful tree grafter, and an all-around tinker who could invent anything. Need something to hold your book upright so you can read while eating? Done. A device to keep the toaster doors from falling open when the bread is extra thick? Done. A contraption that can hold the typing manual and be cranked up so that the line you are following is always at eye level? Done. How about a way to keep the soap from staying wet in the bottom of the soap dish? A scale model of the Globe Theater? A script for a roadshow about the perils of leaving your home teaching until the last day of the month? Done. In his 80s, he could out-golf and out-walk men half his age. And except for the last 3 months of his final illness, he began every morning with the Army battery of vigorous physical fitness exercises. There have been only a handful of American authors who made it solely as a writer, never deviating to take a part-time job. Dad was one of them. He called writing a disease, not a profession or craft, and said that if you've got to have an ailment, I can't think of a better one. In response to the question, what are you going to do when you retire? He would say, retire? Most people plan to write when they retire. What would I retire to? I'm already doing what I love to do. There is an incident that illustrates his disease well. He was a soldier in 1943, waiting to be shipped from New York to Europe, when a story germinated in his head. He dashed to the day room where you could use the typewriter for half an hour if you put a dime in the slot. Fearing that someone would get ahead of him, he didn't stop for change, and he had a couple of dimes. He worked for an hour, and the story was just coming to life, when he became aware of the impatient mutterings of some waiting GIs who wanted to write a letter home. The typewriter went dead in the middle of a page. I'll give you a quarter for a dime, he said to the men in line. No dice. I'll give you 50 cents for a dime. He was told to move on. Dad rose to his feet, waved a dollar bill, and addressed the entire room. A dollar for a dime! There were no takers. Well, he would finish the story with a pen. After a while, the pen went dry, but he had a pencil and a pocket knife, and he continued to write. Then another obstacle. It was 10 o'clock, and the lights went out. So Dad went to the only place where the lights are on all night, and there is a place to sit, the latrine. He completed the story, smuggled it out of camp the next morning, and it shortly appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. Yes, a writer's life demanded focus, the kind of focus displayed when he was discussing an idea for a story. One of them was the new theories of pain treatment, and he was talking with my uncle, who was a doctor. They had gone with their wives to have dinner at Denny's. After paying the bill, the men walked on ahead to the car, unlocked it, got in, and drove off. My mother and aunt stood on the curb dumbfounded. the men traveled all 5 miles home, deeply engrossed in conversation, parked the car, got out to walk into the house, and then noticed there were no women. "Where are the girls?" they asked each other, completely baffled. What Dad loved to do was get the story. Every subject was fair game, and nothing escaped his interest. When the periodic predictions arose about an impending earthquake that would sink California into the sea, his relatives asked him to move to Utah for safety. "Bontz, why would I move now? I want to see the show." His assignment during World War II was made to order in the public relations office of the Tactical Air Force in the European Theater of War, with a headquarters in London. He had permanent travel orders, could hop on any plane at any time to go where the action was to get a story. In the office, he rubbed shoulders with co-workers Ernest Hemingway, Andy Rooney, Bill Hurst, and Herb Kane. In spite of the danger and hardship, they were glory days for him. He loved the British people. He rhapsodized about walking through London, although he would say, "There are only two kinds of weather in England. One is cold, the other is very cold. Summer comes on Wednesday, and on Thursday it is fall again." He was proud he helped stop Hitler's madness. To the day he died, tears would stream down his cheeks whenever he thought of the sight of the liberation of the imprisoned Jews. "I didn't know what hell was until I saw them coming out of the concentration camp." In December 1944, my father cheated death twice. He flew from Paris to England one night when the channel was blanketed in dense fog. The airplane was totally demolished and burned following a crash landing, and Dad was one of two to survive. Later that month, he found himself behind enemy lines during the bloody Battle of the Bulge. The German troops passed by within 3 miles. If discovered, he surely would have been shot, for the Germans were taking no prisoners at that time. I think that these two events were the turning point in Dad's life. He came to believe that he had been spared for a reason, and that reason was to tell the story of his unique Mormon heritage. Hugh B. Brown, president of the British Mission at the time, became Dad's special mentor and encouraged him in the task. When he arrived stateside in late 1945, three distinct paths diverged in front of Dad. Disney's agents literally greeted him on the dock, urging him to return to his successful career in America's entertainment market. The military wanted to keep him for the honored purpose of writing the entire history of the Air Force in World War II. And he was laboring with the responsibility he felt to tell his family's story. Like Frost's traveler, Dad chose the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Even knowing there would be obstacles and opposition from church authorities to family members, he carried high the torch of the truth of Mormon history. Believing that there is no single truth, however sensitive, one-tenth as dangerous as a half-truth, he proceeded to tell the story of his father and grandfather, warts and all. As publication dates passed and books were distributed, it became evident that Dad's church membership was not on the line as he had feared it would be, and it was only then that he walked into the Redwood City ward and asked, "Where do the gray-haired and humpback old deacons meet?" BYU professor Richard Craycroft has described Dad as a masterful ironist, someone who could see the gap between that which we are and that which we would be. Dad called himself a gadfly and delighted in keeping the authorities on their toes. Why was there a clean-shaven Adam on the cover of the priesthood manual? What brand of razor did he use? Brigham Young said that Adam and his family paid tithing. Pray tell, to whom? Dad was proud that his grandfather was wanted by the feds and had the reward poster on prominent display at home. And he took special delight in displaying his laminated coffee permit. Many people have been surprised through the years when they have learned that Dad faithfully attended priesthood meeting every Sunday. They equated speaking out and telling the truth with anti-Mormon behavior. If the facts were known, Dad can be credited with baptisms, reactivations, and the building of testimonies in the hundreds. Dubbed the guru of troubled Mormons, and possessing such a regal heritage, hundreds of whom we affectionately called pilgrims flocked to his door to meet him, to talk, to seek advice. Mom fed them delicious meals with homemade bread, while Dad, without fail, professed his belief in the church. How could he not believe in that for which his father and grandfather struggled and suffered so? Various church members may have faults. After all, they are only human. But concerning the church and those spiritual moments which involve the Savior, there is no question. One of my favorite memories occurred a year and a half ago. I was able to take Dad to Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay, where scenes for Flubber were being filmed. The red carpet was rolled out for him. The directors, producers, and everybody rushed up and asked him to autograph their shooting script and mentioned how much they enjoyed his movie. Robin Williams, a gracious man, sat down with Dad for half an hour and explained that he and his children just roll on the floor every time they watch The Absent-Minded Professor. And he felt that it was his turn to do something for Dad, and he hoped that this new production would maintain the integrity of the original story. The most special moment, however, came during lunch. One of the crew members toasted Dad and said how amazing it was to think that all of the 2,000 people working there that day were there because of an idea of one single man. What a wonderful affirmation to receive towards the end of a life's work. I always enjoyed my time alone with Dad when I was driving him to appointments. Without exception, he commented on our blessed country. "I never look around," he would say, without thinking what an incredibly wealthy country America is and how fortunate we are. I saw thousands of people throughout Europe with literally nothing, living out of wheelbarrows, and we just take all of this for granted. A few weeks after his 90th birthday, in February 1997, he remarked, "I'm in favor of fasting. It's an ancient practice, and it doesn't hurt anybody. It can only help. At age 90, though, getting stronger may be an illusion." Well, indeed it was an illusion. At the end of June, he was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. During the remaining 3 months, as always, he was humorous and unexpected. When asked if he would like to watch 60 Minutes, he responded, "I wouldn't last that long." Or when asked if he had a good night's sleep, he replied, "I haven't decided yet." Once, when preparing to take a new medicine, he declared, "I hope you're not hearing the last words of Samuel W. Taylor." I doubt if anyone will ever hear the last words of Samuel W. Taylor. He continues to speak through the rich legacy of articles, books, videos, television shows, and community theater productions, and in the lives of all of those he has affected in some way. When I think of Dad, I think of trees, especially the tall redwoods and majestic oaks in our area of California, which he loved so much. Like them, he was a manifestation of strength, unimpeachable integrity, and endurance. Dad was troubled in his last days. He had one more story to tell, he said, and he didn't want to die prematurely. As we all began to prepare ourselves for the inevitable, it became apparent what that story would be. Can you imagine what it must be like for Dad to finally meet John Taylor, or to talk with his father who died when Dad was only 8? With a tangible sense of purpose once again, Dad set forth on his journey. He has a notebook and clip-on pencil in his pocket, and I can guarantee that we have not heard the last words of Samuel W. Taylor. I have no doubt that he'll find some way to get the story to us. Anyone have an extra dime? Thank you.
Well, I feel very honored to be asked to be part of this panel to honor Sam. I feel a little overexposed in this symposium, and I'll keep my remarks short, but it is an opportunity to talk about him from my perspective as a writer. It's an amazing thing. You who don't do much writing may not realize it, but to support yourself fully by freelance writing is a miracle in our culture, and he's one of the very few, the only Mormon I know who's done it, and one of the very few in our country. My favorite story about his writing and the achievement of it is one he told in an interview he had 3 years ago here at Sunstone with Levi Peterson. He told about being asked to participate in an officer training program here in Salt Lake City at the beginning of the war, and his brother Raymond, who was a source of much of his research and ideas, collaborator, and dear friend, told him about the dream mine. You can still see the scar on the mountain down there by Provo. It's a reminder of our gullibility as Mormons. But he decided to come down and interview the bishop who had promoted this fraud for about 50 years. And he did. Got an overnight pass. Raymond brought him down. They had a long interview in which the bishop said to him, well, if you just, it's too bad you aren't going to be here next week when the mine is finally going to come through. Of course, he'd been saying that every week for nearly 50 years. But Sam wrote the story, sent it to his agent in New York, and it was eventually published in Esquire. And then he got a letter from his brother Raymond saying, the authorities of the church are very happy with your story, Sam. They feel it's the first story that has completely shown what a fraud this whole thing is, which they've wanted to do. And he said, and the dreamers are all very happy with your story because they say it really finally vindicates that this really is going to work. And Sam's comment was, that's the only time I've ever been able to do that, which is to please both sides. And if any of you have ever tried to write and please both sides, you know what an achievement that was. Sam called himself in that interview a carping curmudgeon, and he also called himself at one time an eating Mormon, which he defined as one who went to war dinners only. That changed, as Sarah reminded us, in 1952, when he, after anticipating that he would have action taken against him by the church for his book, his great book, Family Kingdom, found out that wasn't going to happen, and so showed up at the Redwood Ward and asked to be assigned to the deacons. I have thought that I might title my remarks, Sam as a Marvelous Contradiction in Terms. He was both the kind of person who would contradict any terms you applied to him, but any term you applied tended to be a contradiction because he was a wonderful kind of illusion in many ways and yet a very real person. And this illusion connected with his activity in the church is an interesting and complex one. I first knew him in 1965. I went out to visit Gay and Sam at their home. I knew his work and heard he lived there and wanted to get to know them, visited that home that he built, including making the adobe bricks, his little shack out in back with the two typewriters in it. And at that time, David Haight was the president of the stake. And it was very interesting to me. I wasn't able to attend the graveside service last fall. I was out of town, but I got a copy of it. And I was very interested to find that David Haight had sent a letter to the memorial service, now an apostle, a fond memory of Sam. Let me read it to you. As president of the Palo Alto Stake during the 1950s and early 60s, I was well acquainted with Samuel Woolley Taylor, who is a member of the Redwood City Ward of our stake. He wrote a most interesting feature article for a national magazine about the church's welfare system, featuring the Redwood City Cannery, where we produced much of the welfare needs for peaches, pears, apricots, and tomatoes, shipping them by truck to Salt Lake City for distribution. He told of bankers, butchers, bakers, teachers, and Relief Society sisters washing the fruit and putting it in cans by the thousands, even attaching the labels. Sam wrote of the loving relationship and camaraderie of faithful church followers of the Savior helping people in need. The article was a winner. The Elder Haight continues, I felt I knew Sam's heart as we discussed many issues, including his father's disagreement with church officials, but who was later reinstated. Sam was not only very bright, but a good man, and I enjoyed his friendship. And I called him to serve as the Elders' Quorum President, and he touched many hearts. My wife Ruby and I joined with Sam and Gay's many friends in expressing sorrow over his death and extend our deepest sympathy to Gay and their family, as well as Sam's living brothers and sisters. Sarah, is that true? The funny thing about that letter is it's not true. That is, he was not called as an Elders' Quorum President. But I think President Haight, later Elder Haight, sincerely remembers that he called him as an Elders' Quorum President. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think the perfect symbol of the irony and the illusion, if you will, of Sam. That is, he was able to create, by his goodness, in President Haight's mind, the illusion that he had called him as an Elders' Quorum President. On the other hand, and this is sad, he's able to create the illusion in people's many people's minds that he's a heretic, or against the church, or an enemy of the church. Both are illusions. Both are an interesting part of this complex person. He's like that story of the elephant that people touch from different sides and find something different, each of them depending on themselves and what they're looking for. I found it very interesting that at that service, this letter from an apostle was read, and one of the speakers was Ogden Kraut, a fundamentalist, a polygamist, and writer, who was Sam's friend and paid a tribute to him. And that Richard Craycroft, a professor at BYU, a sophisticated thinker about literature, was there to pay tribute to the man who resurrected, if you will, the wonderful novel that Sam had written, Heaven Knows Why, and thought would get him in trouble and did get him in trouble. He sometimes felt very bitter about the way that novel was received in the church, and for many years did seem to establish his relationship as an enemy to the church. Let me just read from Richard Craycroft's article, Fresh in the Dearth, which was a fine article in Sunstone about the novel, and I think reinstituted it in the Mormon canon for all of us who love good humor and find it so rare in the church. But he has this to say in a memorandum in the BYU library. When the story began about Heaven Can Wait, I'm sorry, Heaven Knows Why. When the story began running in Collier's, the mail poured in. Some readers thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever read, but the reaction of others made me realize that the Mormons simply were not accustomed to the type of literature about themselves which was so enjoyed by Jews and Gentiles about themselves. Mormons had been conditioned to judging by black and white, for or against. Literature either had to be faith-promoting and full of flawless stereotypes as characters, or was anti-Mormon, and there was nothing in between. That was his experience with the response to that novel, and I think it hurt him a great deal, because as he also said, he saw that as his missionary work, and it was. I think that did much for the image of the Mormons and to convince people that we are human beings of complexity and the ability to laugh at ourselves, which he had. Richard, as Sarah read from him, talks about this gap between the ideal and the real that Sam felt so well and understood. And part of it had to do, of course, with his own history, that of his family. The grandson of a president of the church who was wanted by the feds, the son of an apostle who was excommunicated, a very complex family and a very complex relationship to polygamy, which I think on the one hand he was very much personally opposed to, but on the other hand felt, given those conditions, he had to explore and in ways defend, make real in his books, and he did that. He had seen, through his research, the church at its worst, I think particularly in that excommunication of John Woolley, Taylor, and in some ways at its best, as he was involved with Raymond in the reinstatement of his father's blessings through President McKay late in his life in 1965, invited to his office and reports that remarkable experience where the decision was made to reinstate those blessings. Richard talks about the irony last fall of having that service during General Conference. Now, Sam would have laughed that they were all gathered there solemnly rather than being at home watching conference as they should have been, including stake president Richard Craycroft. And he loved to point out those ironies. The irony was, I think, even more complex by the fact that Richard, who is the one who in many ways brought Sam Taylor as a great writer to the attention of the Mormon literary community through his article, and has championed him and should be here speaking right now instead of me, is not here because he is a professor at BYU and felt he couldn't. Wouldn't Sam love but be hurt by that irony? The ironies continue. Well, I've talked long enough, but I thought Sam's voice ought to be heard here. So if you'll forgive me, I'd like to just read something he wrote and then something Richard wrote about him that I think completes our sense of what an interesting contradiction in terms he was. This is from his essay that he wrote for us when we started dialogue, just a few years after, called Little Did She Realize, Writing for the Mormon Market. And he has a long passage at the beginning about the problems of trying to write for the market, and then tells us how to go about it. This is the kind of story that Mormon editors, then the improvement era, but pretty accurate today about what the Ensign might want to see in its own way. If you want to write for the Mormon market, this is the he'll help you out here. Take this down, and you can write your own. Janice is a beautiful and talented girl, see, who takes drama at BYU and yearns to be a great actress. But her boyfriend, Claude, wants her to stay home, marry him, and have babies. Claude, however, runs a dairy farm, and Janice wants fame and glamour, not manure on her shoes. Well, Janice is in an MIA play, and by an astounding coincidence, a great Hollywood producer is in the audience. How he got there is your problem. Anyhow, the producer flips over Janice's talent and beauty. He's got to have her for the starring role in his new $50 million movie. So Janice's fondest dreams have come true. Everybody thinks it's a wonderful thing, and she's packing her bags when in comes Claude with hay in his hair and manure on his shoes. He's heard the news while milking, and he says he's just come to say goodbye, and gosh, honey, I'm going to miss you something terrible because, gee whiz, I love you. At this moment, Janice comes to realize that she doesn't want the tinsel and glitter of Hollywood. What she really wants is to be with Claude and have manure on her shoes, bear his babies, and use her great talent as award drama director of MIA. Fade out. We can laugh, but this is really what BYU wants now instead of Brian Evanson. Maybe that's a good choice. Maybe you think this isn't much of a story because you've already read it a dozen times in the Improvement Era and Relief Society magazine. Well, if you've only read it a dozen times, that shows how young you are. Utah editors love the come-to-realize story. Janice is sometimes a great writer, sometimes a great painter or singer or violinist. You've got all the arts and the instruments in the orchestra see before you run out of material. Who comes to realize? Fade out. There are infinite variations to the come-to-realize story. Janice is an orphan girl whose foster parents don't love her, so she's going to run away, but then she comes to realize that they do love her. Fade out. Janice is a little old lady who rebels at going to an old folks' home, but she comes to realize that that's what such homes are for. Old folks like her. Fade out. Janice is a housewife who can't have babies, so she takes in a foster child, but the child doesn't love her, and she's going to take it back when she comes to realize. Trouble with the come-to-realize plot, my agent told me years ago, and kicking back the only one of that type I ever sent him, is that there's no actual story development. The only thing that happens is that Janice changes her mind. For the professional market, that won't do, but Utah editors can't get enough stories of Janice changing her mind, particularly the one where she comes to realize that manure on her shoes is better than pursuing the arts. Well, again, if you think you've got Sam fixed, there's an illusion there, too. And let me end with this from Richard, reminding us that it is an illusion. I think Sam's, this is Richard Craycross speaking at the graveside service. I think Sam's contribution to church literature is sort of characterized by a telephone call I got from my brother, Paul, about 6 months ago. Many of you know Paul Craycroft up at the University of Utah, who's a fine poet himself. Paul was kind of weeping, and he's really not that type, and I asked him what was going on. You know, a year ago, Paul responded, you know, a year ago you loaned me a copy of Family Kingdom about the Taylors. I'd been putting it off, and I just read it all night long. And he said, it is the best thing I had ever read. And when I got to that part where John W. is dying, and he says, as the people are coming in to be with him in his home, in his room, and his wife was there, be still, the Savior is passing through the room, I broke down and I wept. And I can't think of that without weeping. And I said, why don't you write Sam and tell him? And I don't know whether or not Paul did, but I hope so. And Richard continues, I was similarly moved by that, and I was similarly moved by his account about when John Taylor was dying in Family Kingdom. I mean, sorry, in The Kingdom or Nothing. And he said the Savior had come to him. I guess I've read all of Sam's published writings and a whole sheaf of his private letters, and it seems to me that the irony of his life is a very genuine religious irony. He sees that we in the outward church below are flawed. He sees that our goal is to become perfect, to realize perfection, and he laughs at the places where there is a gap betwixt those things. Sam realizes that when it comes to talking about the first encounters, when it comes to talking about those spiritual moments which involve the Savior, which involve his grandfather and his father and even himself, and which involve all of us, those Sam does not jest about. And you read knowing that the man who wrote this could not have done so without a deep and profound belief in those moments. I believe that. It's meaningful to me that Sam's, one of his favorite hymns sung at his graveside service, was I Stand All Amazed. And maybe I could end with just a couple of things since Gay's here. I treasure that, and immediately his mind clicks into a mode, and this is where he goes. Recently, I learned from a reliable source that the base pay for general authorities was $60,000 a year plus perks. They get travel expenses. They sit on boards of directors of church-owned or oriented companies. They receive contracts for church enterprises such as building chapels, supplying material for them, and have management positions. They get 4 tickets to all BYU sports events. Their children have free tuition at Y. He's kind of working himself up here. They receive a free car every year. They have expense accounts. I was told that one GA made $500,000 a year, another $400,000 a year. It seems to me that while the love of money is the root of all evil, it's okay to make your pile if you hate the filthy lucre. Then he calms down. Comes back down to earth and talks about some very gentle things and ends with this wonderful farewell that I didn't understand until recently. Selah, you know, that he always signed his letters, Selah. I had assumed it was like shalom. Do you all know what it means? I didn't learn about it until I was teaching the Psalms in my gospel doctrine class, and I did a little research and find out you find it throughout the Psalms. And I did a little research, and the best translation of it has to do with the musical notation, indicating to the players along the Psalms what they should do. The best translation of it is strike up the band. I love that. That's the way Sam ended his letters.
Ladies and gentlemen, I really feel honored by the opportunity to speak here. In fact, I'm probably more honored than I deserve. I'm sure there are many out there who know Sam better than I, and probably were more faithful friends than I was. But nonetheless, I'm here, and I'll do the best I can, and I think I have some interesting things to say about Sam. I met Sam through a paper that he wrote, 1988 Sunstone Symposium. Virginia Burgess actually was the one that introduced me to that paper. It was about Annalise Guerin, the Mormon mystic, and I think Virginia will mention a little bit about that too. I won't go on about it, but nonetheless, at the time I was very interested in mystical things. As some of you will discover tomorrow, I was in the government's so-called psychic espionage program for many years, and from that developed an appreciation for so-called otherworldly things. And here was an article about a Mormon who pursued those sorts of things. Whether or not she ended up as a legitimate mystic or not, it's hard to say, and Sam himself doesn't come to that conclusion. But the article itself was wonderful. He did a marvelous job of explaining her history, and commenting on it, and at the same time not passing judgment on her. And he seemed to have a gift at doing that sort of thing, although he wasn't shy of passing judgment on something he felt that deserved it. Sam also, of course, was a man of great opinions. I exchanged letters with him off and on for a couple of years, and I didn't meet him in person until May of 1990, or maybe it was June, I don't remember. I was out at Alameda Naval Station on an assignment or doing some counter-narcotics operations. I had an afternoon off, and so I persuaded one of my co-workers, a young woman who was not Mormon, but who I thought would get along with Sam very well because of her personality, and we both hopped in the car and at your expense drove across the Bay Bridge and arrived at in Redwood City and went up to visit Sam. And I had a wonderful time. My colleague fell in love with Sam immediately, in a very altruistic sense, gay, I assure you. She was very impressed with his wit. She enjoyed gay as well. We had some great discussions there. I got a first-hand experience with that famous studio out back, where I was amazed that all the things that were attributed to Sam came out of there, and amazed at the antiquity of the typewriter that he was working on, and we were just the dawning of the computer age, and I brought up the idea that maybe he would want to switch to computer. I don't remember what he said, but I was well chastened by the time he was done. We continued thereafter to exchange letters, and we met also at Sunstone. In fact, I got sort of a Sam Taylor Memorial Luncheon going. Anytime Sam was in town, we tried to arrange one lunch during Sunstone when Sam and Gay and I would go to lunch, and we somehow, it was like one of those snowballs starting down the hill. By the time we got to lunch, it was about four tables full of people all here, you know, because Sam Taylor was there, and they enjoyed his comments. The interesting thing about Sam was that, at least in the time I knew him, he was really almost an introvert. He was the sort of person who kept his counsel and waited till the right opportunity to slip in the rapier, you know, and he was very good at that. I've always, being quite an extrovert, I've always been disconcerted by people who don't say anything until they have something to say. And I sit there and try and fill the vacuum, you know, and talk and talk and talk, and then I start wondering, oh, this guy must think I'm a real idiot because I won't stop blathering. But the interesting thing, and I think it serves a writer well, is that by doing that, by sitting back and not commenting, you actually learn far more about the person you're dealing with than you would if you tried to get in your 2 cents worth. Now, Sam put in far more than 2 cents worth, but he did it in a very economic fashion that stung when it was intended to, and calmed when it was intended to, and it generally was, it was well, a great reward for waiting for him to make his comments. I see Sam, well, as many of you know, the Orson Scott Card had a series called, you know, and featured a guy named Ender. And the second book in that series was named after the office that this Ender character was filling at the time, Speaker for the Dead. And the purpose of the Speaker for the Dead is to come to a funeral of a person and not just deliver a eulogy, but to provide, in a way it is a eulogy, I guess, for the whole community, not just the person themselves, but for the family, for the community, and speak not just glowing, kind kinds of things, but to tell the truth about the interactions of those people and their relationships and how they felt about one another and what they accomplished and what they did and what they really were. Well, I see Sam not as a speaker for the dead, but a speaker for the living. He tried to do that with great success, I think, for our Mormon community. He did it while we were alive, thank goodness. And I think he accomplished much by doing that. I wish many times, have wished many times, and continue to wish that he was better known out there because of the things he had to say. Now, they weren't always palatable to some factions. They weren't always acceptable to others. Others, you know, might receive them with great glee while their opponents would frown and be upset about it all. And he wasn't always right, but he usually was. And so I was felt myself very grateful that I had the opportunity to get to know him at least a little bit while he was still around. And I count myself further grateful that there are so many things that he wrote and contributed that I still have an opportunity to find out about. I'm going to share a few things. Well, share a few things with you. First, I want to note that he obviously wrote on many topics. Most of them focus on something to do with Mormonism. The church, history, whatever. I'm just going to read the title of a few of these papers. Now, some of them have been published, some of them haven't. One I really get a kick out of is Anti-Mormon I Ain't, spelled A-U-N-T-Y. Anti-Mormon I Ain't, nor Anti-Mormon Either. And here, in this paper, he's taking issue with some of the popular theories of the origin and development of polygamy. You'll have to read that to get the full benefit of it. He's got one, "Whoa, man, that's not history." Or, I'm sorry, "Whoa, man, what's not history? You had better believe it." And, of course, that was a take on Hugh Nibley's "No, Man, That's Not History," which was a rebuttal to Von Brody's "No Man Knows My History." So, interesting point-counterpoint going on there. You almost have to read all three of them to know what's going on. And even then, you're not quite sure sometimes. He's got The Case for Carping Criticism, Report from the Doghouse. I think in his case that was a very well-furnished doghouse. Here is probably one of the classics of equivocation. Are Mormons Christian? Well, yes, no, and maybe. The Second Coming? Wait a second. What day and what hour? He's got Ghost from the Grave, which is about John D. Lee. And there's a bunch more which I didn't bring with me, so I can't quote you the titles of them. But it gives you a feel for the kind of the broad coverage of things that he addressed. And since my relationship mostly was through letters with him, I'm going to read some excerpts of his letters to kind of give you a flavor for some of the other topics he wrote on. First one I picked is writing and editors. I think you'll get an appreciation for that. First one was in response to a question I'd asked him. He was on the program for the Washington, D.C. symposium in April of, 1989 maybe. And he was a little perplexed by that because he didn't know he was on the schedule. He says, "Curious that I'm scheduled for the Sunstone Symposium there in April. I just happened to mention to Russell Holtgren in a recent note I was thinking of doing Joseph Smith visits Redwood City First Ward. Russ is president and only member of the Sam Taylor Fan Club, Annapolis branch. Now, I mentioned Russ Holtgren because he's had a relationship for a long time with Sam through letters, I guess probably 2 or 3 decades maybe. I tried to get a hold of him and wasn't able to. I would have liked him to have made some comments, or at least passed them on through me. At any rate, apparently Russ was the one that got him on that program, hoping to induce Sam to come to the symposium. It obviously didn't work. Anyway, he goes on. Russ wrote that somebody told him any book with nurses in the title sold 1 million copies. So why didn't I give a subtitle to the John Taylor papers, The Satanic Nurses? I told him a publisher told me that any book with how-to in the title was a bestseller, so it would be How to Make the Satanic Nurses. And I have to thumb through these to find the next one. Ah. Now, he had submitted a piece to a Mormon publication. I won't divulge the name here. But it was rejected. And these were his comments, which led into other comments about editors. Wow. And this was the editorial comment. It was not only a lousy job of writing, but I was unspiritual. I have the sneaking suspicion that this publication has been baptized. I long ago learned that editors don't agree. An editor bounced a story of mine because it was too funny. He didn't mind a laugh now and then, but when there's a gag in every paragraph, it was just too much. The next editor was a guy who didn't hurt when he laughed. And the classic case of Mormon humor was my Heaven Knows Why. I was in the doghouse for 30 years before Professor Richard Craycroft of BYU told the Saints it was funny. After that, they loved it. And I appreciate the early comments about Craycroft. That's good. Obviously, as anybody who knew him, the center point of his life, besides his writing, was his wife, Gay. They had a wonderful relationship going on for decades. Far longer than most marriages even think of lasting, unfortunately. And he always included her as much as possible. He's mentioned before that Gay gave up her own promising career because of his more or less promising career, I guess. And he's always honored her for that. But he made some interesting comments and letters about Gay, indirectly. I'm going to include some of those here. This one was, he wrote me a letter in response to my second marriage. In fact, this letter is dated the day after that occurrence. He says, "Well, you're an old marriage stiff again. Congratulations and best wishes. Your comment that marriage was like eating mushrooms, that you didn't know if you'd made a mistake until it was too late, is right on the mark. But I think it depends a great deal on whether you are friends as well as lovers. Anyhow, I'm wondering if now you qualify for the celestial glory. When my brother Raymond's wife died, the widows tried to entrap him. Invitations to dinners, meetings, shows, whatever. He would have none of it. A son of his father, he wanted the glory, and all the widows were sealed for eternity to their former husbands. But where in Utah to find a middle-aged spinster? I was with him when he hit the jackpot." We were at the Genealogical Society headquarters in Salt Lake, at that time in the old Montgomery Ward building, and from the secret files he received a list of President John Taylor's official 7 wives and also 9 lesser-known ones. He gave the list to the girl at the Xerox machine. She turned white. "Oh, I couldn't copy that for you." So we went outside. He said, "Sam, I'm folding this and putting it in my inside jacket pocket. If I'm hit by a car before we reach a Xerox, take it out before calling an ambulance." We made it. The source of the document was Ruth Fors, a middle-aged spinster, and he married her. I'm afraid he found out that he'd eaten the wrong mushroom, but it was worth it to attain the glory. It isn't supposed to be easy. As to friends and lovers, I was in love with 2 girls, but not friends, before marrying Gay. And while overseas during World War II, I was both in love and friends with a beautiful WAC. But we never slept together. I was married, and she was engaged to a Navy man. So when I kissed her goodbye, there were no regrets, just fond memories. Now, my wife and I debated whether I ought to read that passage, and we both agreed that Gay probably already knew that story. And so I figured it showed Sam's character. While recognizing the foibles of human nature, he also had principles and integrity, and he honored those things. Somewhere I have another. Well, this kind of blends into his feelings about the temple. But it also has to do with Gay. He says, "When I made an honest woman out of Gay, it was during a temple excursion to Los Angeles. We started out in the evening in a chartered bus with square wheels and a leak in the exhaust system, which permeated the interior with fumes. I was alone in the wide rear seat, shuttling back and forth on the slick plastic with every turn. When we arrived next morning at the temple, there was still an hour and a half to catch up on our sleep. But the driver yelled, 'All out,' so I lined up at the temple door like roosters in the rain until opening time. As we entered, they said, 'This line for the living and that line for the dead.'" Gay whispered, "Where's the line for the half-dead?" We returned in the square-wheeled bus and staggered off to catch up on sleep. Next Sunday, the people excitedly talked about the glorious experience. And at last, I understood. It was because of the hardships that made it wonderful. Now that we have a temple at Oakland, what's the big deal? I actually have lots of other things to read, but I think I don't have time to read them. I had an affinity with Sam because of my military involvement. He was very proud of his military service, and I'm glad Sarah introduced us to some of that. He was a profound letter writer and wrote Gay every day while he was overseas, that he was able to do that. I guess when he was trapped behind the German lines, it probably wasn't much of an opportunity for mailing a letter. But nonetheless, those letters are collected, as Gay told me, in 4-bound volumes, which I'd love to get a hold of and read through sometime. He had an interesting side to him, too, pointed up by the Annalise Karen story. He wasn't exactly a mystic, but he had a place for that in his life. My unique connection with Sam and Gay is partly because of my involvement in what I mentioned before, this esoteric psychic kind of stuff. I'm also a dowser because of that, somewhat of one, not a very good one, but you know, Gay is as well. A few decades back, she was introduced to it and has done had some quite interesting experiences with her dowsing skills. She uses a thing she calls the wire, which is what a dowser would call an L-rod. Normally, that's just a piece of wire that goes up and comes across like this in an L-shape, but her L-rod was crafted for her, especially by her husband, Sam. He was very supportive of that, and he would tell me some of the stories as well. She apparently has become very proficient in the use of it, and it's interesting, and the reason I bring that up is because that puts Sam and Gay in very illustrious company. At a time when many of us would dismiss that kind of thing, because of our own ignorance, they were willing at least to pursue it and use it in their lives. It's interesting that the same holds true for Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, who himself was a dowser. If you look in the 7th section of the Book of Commandments, you'll find a passage related to Oliver Cowdery saying that he has that gift, the gift of working with the rod, which is, of course, the euphemism for dowsing. So, in more than one way, Sam and Gay have perpetuated the Mormon traditions and Mormon heritage, looking at them, of course, critically, but perpetuating them as well in important and profound ways. I'm very glad that Gay could make it here. The focus today is on Sam, but you almost can't have Sam without Gay. And she was an integral part of his life and was very important to him. I'm going to close. Sam's marvelous storytelling and writing talents, of course, landed him a job, his writing job, with the military, and ended up getting him a commission into the officer corps. I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, he's been bumped up to second lieutenant already up there behind the pearly gates. And his assignment is to wipe the smirks off the faces of the smug and to kick the lawn chairs out from under the spiritually complacent. We certainly miss him here, but I bet he's doing a darn fine job. Yes. Thank you.
Well, I wonder what there's left to say about this remarkable man. I didn't realize when I called him. I'd read a paper about Annalise Guerin, and I hadn't read a paper, I'd heard a tape, and it wasn't enough, and I thought, well, I've got to know more about this. I'd read one of her books, and now here's a man who's written a paper. I didn't know who he was. I called Sunstone. They said, oh, that's Sam Taylor out in Redwood City. Why don't you give him a call? Well, I hadn't the slightest idea who he was. They said, oh, he'd love to hear from you. Go ahead and call. So I did. And I got Sam on the phone, and then pretty soon I heard Gay. He was saying, Gay, pick up the thing. There's someone, a live one on the wire or something. And the fact that I knew nothing about him at all, he was delighted. And so it began there. He began to tell me about his other writing and that he was John Taylor's grandson. And I'm afraid it took me really off guard. And I had the temerity. Polygamy wasn't one of my favorite things. And I said, oh, well, how do you feel about polygamy? And he said, well, how do you feel about it? I said, well, I think it's a big mistake. And he said, well, that's the way Gay feels, too, but I still talked her into marrying me anyway. So that's the way he always did things. He evaded. And I soon learned that he had written books, and he sent me a list, and I started ordering them, and I shared them with the family, and we all became really fans of his writings. And I was so impressed. I have a history major, and I always thought history was so dull, but he just made history wonderful, and you could never quite figure out whose side he was on. And people would want to say, well, whose side is he on? Well, it was really hard to tell. I never could know. And he kept an awful lot of opinions to himself. I remember one particular time I had mentioned that I was studying about reincarnation, and I thought that was quite an interesting idea, and I kind of wanted him to tell me what he thought. And he said, well, Gay thinks it's interesting, too. But he didn't say what he thought. But then later we were at a meeting, and we were having lunch with some friends of his. And I think he thought it was a little dull, so he said, this lady believes in reincarnation. Well, that started quite a debate. And he just sat back and smiled while I talked about this, and I wasn't very prepared to talk about it either, but that was he kind of liked that kind of thing. Here's a quote from one of his letters. After that call, there was just always letters going back and forth. It says, P.S., what's happening here? Well, a guy waved $2 million in my face. If I'd let him put up 8 big houses in my back acre. Now, I ought to tell you, we did visit his home that fall, my husband and I, in our trailer house. And we received the royal treatment with the toaster that and Sarah cooked us a wonderful meal, and we just had a marvelous time. So we knew about this spacious area he had in the middle of Redwood City. So when he told me this, he said, a guy waved $2 million deal in my face if I'd let him put up 8 big houses in my back acre. But as Gay said, what would we do with the money that we can't do anyhow? I've had a yen to play a round of golf at the old course at St. Andrews, Scotland, but I could do that anyhow. Finally, however, I figured what I'd do with the $2 million. I could buy a Rolls Royce and hire a chauffeur to drive me around to the garage sets. So then we bought a house in St. George, and I mentioned that in a letter, and then I read The Giant Joshua, and so he had a lot to say about that. He says, my feeling about The Giant Joshua was that it was authentic, relentlessly so. It was so grim. In fact, the only uplift in the book was when the heroine died at the end. If any of you have read the book, you know he tells it right. It's a wonderful book. But here's something. It was going to winter in St. George, he says he had a wonderful friend down there who was a widower, and that he thought I should look him up and cheer him up a little. And he said he was an editor of the BYU school newspaper when I was there, and I wrote a column for it, which got me kicked out of college 6 times. Being a sensitive soul, I got the idea I wasn't entirely welcome, so I never did try to get back in and finish my senior year. That was, his letters were a lot of fun. I think it's been fun, and we could all say a lot more about him, but you get the picture that he was an interesting friend, and anybody who had him as a friend knew how fun he was. So we probably could have a few questions now if anyone has any they would like to ask anyone here. Okay. That.
I think that sounds like a great project for you.
Yeah. Well, I sensed the first time I called him that this was going to be an interesting thing, so I put a folder in my file cabinet for Sam Taylor, and I started filing. I had one about this thick, and obviously he did a lot of writing, and there'd be lots of material.
Did he keep copies of all his correspondence in the mail out?
I doubt it, because he had this old typewriter. He didn't have a computer. I doubt he ever did that. Huh? Yes, go ahead.
He did. He used a lot of carbon paper. There are 14 boxes of his papers at the Utah Historical Society on Rio Grande Avenue in Salt Lake, which is what he sent up about 10 years ago, I think. And in it is correspondence with a lot of different people, a lot of well-known Mormon people, Fon Brody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're open to the public, absolutely free access. I haven't gone through his office yet, but he intended for the rest of his material also to go to the Historical Society, so it will be going there.
Have they done any work in cataloging and organizing?
Yes, they can tell you what's in each box. That's very good. And as far as, there's been no plans about publishing the letters, but I do know that his book, The Kingdom or Nothing, about John Taylor, is being reprinted and will be issued in October with the title The Last Pioneer by Signature Books. And they intend to bring out some of the other ones after that one comes out.
Well, Family Kingdom has already been reprinted.
Yeah.
And it's available now.
Virginia, while we're talking about letters, we've been saying that Gay was indispensable to Sam and certainly his equal in every way. And I thought I'd offer some evidence because she wrote letters too. And here's from a letter. I think, shows something of her spirit and similarity and wit to Sam. She'd written me about another matter, and then she just plunks this right in here. We are reading now in the Mercury News a daily section of the book A Question of Character by Thomas C. Reeves about the rather swinish, hypocritical, greedy, soulless John Kennedy. My instinct always told me he was evil. I could never stand to be in a room where the TV brought his voice or person there. If I had to rate the worst presidents we have ever had, they are number one, Reagan, number two, John Kennedy, number three, Harding. How did I get off the subject? Carry on.
Well, I could have mentioned I had quite a few letters from Gay and quite a few conversations. You never knew who was going to write the letters, and they were equally fun. It was just a very special thing to happen to me, just a greenhorn writer. Any other questions or comments? Okay.
In Dad's file cabinets, there's just an incredible amount of scripts and plays and short stories that have not been published. Everything from Porter Rockwell and Jacob Hamlin to the Three Nephites to Gorilla Go Home and the whole range of church to funny material. And I quite frankly don't know what to do with them other than to send them to the Utah Historical Society. But if anybody has any ideas or any interest in any material or something, please contact us and we'd be glad to let you see them or whatever. Okay. Yes.
How much of the character in that one is essentially the
autobiographical? He said, how much of the character in The Absent-Minded Professor was autobiographical? His shop looks just like the shop in the movie. He was much more organized than that man. Always had things written down on a pad and was thorough. He wouldn't have forgotten his wedding date. but he was a dreamer. He loved to think about things, fantasize. I guess.
Well, I've really enjoyed doing this, and I hope you've all enjoyed hearing about Sam and getting to know him better. And our time is up, and so thank you.